This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
Almost time for KBOO's spring membership drive. If you're able to give a gift of at least $500, consider doubling your money by sponsoring a matching challenge pledge during the drive. You can offer to match every gift during the show of your choice up to the amount you choose. This is a great way to motivate others so we can reach our goal and wrap up the drive early. If you're interested, please contact KBOO's membership coordinator. You can email membership@kboo.org. or call 503-231-8032, extension 207.
KBOO celebrates International Women's Day on March 8th with 24 hours of programming by and about women.
To be a woman is a lot of different things. I think these are all things I've realized in my adult life, but for a long time I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to identify as a woman, and I think I've always associated it with powerlessness and weakness.
In the years since Margaret Cho first started doing stand-up comedy at age 16, she herself has become a role model for many, and she has done so on her own terms. Her work has given voice and validity to experiences that do not conform to straight white norms.
KBOO celebrates International Women's Day on March 8th with 24 hours of programming by and about women.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater, presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 11th and 12th, 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a rally in support of immigrants' rights drew thousands to Pioneer Square last Saturday. Washington County was narrowly able to avoid a strike of corrections employees last Friday, and members of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission are considering killing sea lions to save salmon on the Columbia River.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,001 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,270 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is a KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 6, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. An unprecedented multicultural rally in support of immigrants' rights drew thousands to Pioneer Square last Saturday. The rally in March was sponsored by dozens of progressive groups. KBOO's Carlos Chavez has more.
crowd of 2,000 to 3,500 turned out Saturday afternoon for a rally in support of immigrant families and to oppose the latest bill to reach the Senate Judiciary Committee, H.R. 4437, also known as the Sensenbrenner Bill. The march was organized by local labor and immigrant advocates such as the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, Bicun, Bols, and several others.
Gracias por habernos invitado. Vienen compañeros conmigo también.
Thank you for inviting us. I'm accompanied here by many others who work with me.
Es muy importante para nosotros estar aquí, estar unidos con ustedes.
It's very important for us to be here amongst you.
Porque no importa el color de la piel ni el idioma.
Because language and race does not matter.
Todos somos hermanos y tenemos derecho a ser respetados.
We are all brothers and sisters and we all deserve respect.
Y lucharemos.
And we will continue to fight.
Contra estas leyes.
Against anti-immigrant laws.
Nuestros hijos tienen derecho.
Our children have a right.
A tener un futuro mejor.
To have a better future.
Y respeto en los trabajos.
And respect at work.
Gracias, sigamos adelante. ¡Sí se puede!
The culturally diverse crowd was heavily represented by the Mexican community, who peacefully winded their way through downtown and along Front Street.
Would you like to give an opinion as to why you're here?
We're here to support and to fight this measure, that 4437. We all Latinos have to be against it, and all the people here in Oregon have to be against it.
Why is that?
Why? Because it's a discrimination against all labor. What they need to do is go after the employers, not the employees. They're the ones that are hiring people. But we keep the economy going with the employees here, so.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, obviously we need something like this. You know, whether or not we had 9/11, there's a lot of bad people that know the same paths as the good people. Of course, most of these people are good people. Most of these people are working for a living. But the drug dealers know the same things. The terrorists know the same things as the good people do. And we want the border secure. We have the right to know who's coming into America and why they're coming into America. We have the right to know that.
This world has changed drastically in the past 5 years. Okay? We just can't randomly let everybody in because, you know, the enemy lives among us already as far as terrorism.
Yeah, I'm just here because I believe in the rights of immigrants, and that's pretty much it. I'm all for free trade and whatnot, but we should be able to strike a balance. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you.
I'm here because we need to unify. We have to unify as one people, as one nation, as it's written in the Constitution or whatever, you know. I'm against politics, you know, because everything's biased. But I'm here, you know, because I want to support something, a good cause, you know, for human rights. And that's it.
All right, thank you.
I'm here because the bill they're about to pass is going to be devastating for the immigrants that come from different countries all over the world. So we're here to protest it, and we hope that this bill doesn't pass so that the immigrants will get the respect that they need in this community or anywhere else in the United States.
Without a news van to be seen anywhere, the crowd ended their march at PSU. The march was part of a nationwide event which included rallies in New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and California. In Los Angeles, the rally kicked off a two-month run from L.A. to New York to build peace and harmony between laborers and anti-immigrant groups.
That was KBOO's Carlos Chavez reporting. For more information on the Sensenbrenner Bill, go to www.pcun.org.
The Port of Portland wants to hush up an agreement about legal strategy for a Superfund cleanup of the Willamette River. However, a stalemate appears to have been reached between the port, the DA's office, and the Oregonian newspaper. The newspaper petition Trunk's office after the port refused to divulge the documents under Oregon's public records law. District Attorney Michael Shrunk last month ordered port officials to make the terms public, but both the port and the polluters are standing together to block releasing the cleanup agreement's terms. The port's attorney argues that corporations won't want to participate in cleaning up their toxic waste if their agreements with government agencies are made known to the public. The issue remains unresolved.
Portland attorney Ron Saxton won the support of fellow Republicans at the annual Dorchester Conference after he told them he was the best chance to defeat Governor Kulongoski, the Democratic incumbent, in November. State Senator Jason Atkinson, a 35-year-old Jacksonville Republican who's run a mostly grassroots, low-budget campaign, finished a surprising second in a straw poll taken at the conference, held over the weekend in Seaside. That left former State Representative Kevin Mannix, the Republican nominee for governor in 2002, at a distant third. The straw poll is not a scientific poll, but Saxton says it shows that Oregon Republicans are intent on taking back the governor's office after five successive losses to the Democrats. The straw poll was the highlight of the weekend gathering of more than 600 Republican activists from around Oregon.
Washington County was narrowly able to avoid a strike of corrections employees last Friday. KBOO's Isaac Kaplan-Woldner has more on the story.
30 community corrections officers in Hillsborough are going to work today instead of going on strike as planned. The walkout would have occurred at 12:01 today, but a contract agreement was reached with county commissioners late last Friday evening. Details of the agreement have yet to be released, but union representative Don Loving has described the contract as both adequate and short-term. Loving sees the contract agreement as a victory because,
as a governmental unit, Washington County has been notoriously anti-union over the years. They don't want their employees to be part of a union, and not very many of Washington County's employees are. If you compare Washington County to Multnomah or Clackamas or any of the other bigger counties in Oregon, it's the only county where most of the employees, in fact, aren't in some sort of union or association, and the county is trying to keep it that way.
County commissioners had initially been hesitant to negotiate directly with the union. Loving says they spent an unnecessary amount of tax dollars on expensive lawyers.
The firm that they're using out of Portland is a well-known anti-labor law firm, and we encounter them throughout the state frequently in county jurisdictions. However, in most situations, this law firm only advises. In Washington County's case, the firm is actually in the room doing the negotiation. So not only has the county spent $300,000 on a five-year contract just as retainer fees, so that's $60,000 a year retainer-wise, they're also giving this firm $210 per hour for each hour that the county gets billed by the law firm. Now, I have actually given Washington County a public document request for all of 2005, asking to see invoices and other billing statements from the law firm, because I'd like to know, and I think the taxpayers in Washington County would like to know, just how much the county has spent on this law firm.
For KBOO News, I'm Isaac Kaplan-Woolner.
An environmental lawyer with ties to Eugene has been selected to head the war-torn African nation of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Jerome Verdier is part of the Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide. It's a Eugene-based nonprofit network connecting environmental lawyers throughout the world. Verdier was one of the founders of the Green Advocates in Liberia, a public interest law firm that focuses on environmental and human rights issues. Liberia is a country about half the size of Oregon. It's emerging from more than two decades of war and civil strife that scarred the nation with mass killings, rape, abductions, and the recruitment of children as soldiers.
A new study has found that minorities are not joining the ranks of emergency medical technicians despite high job satisfaction and good pay. Oregon State University researchers say more than 9 in every 10 EMTs are white, a figure that puzzles educators and training evaluators. Darlene Russeft, an OSU education professor, says a study suggests that many communities are missing an opportunity to provide high-paying, high-satisfaction jobs to minorities. She also noted that most emergency medical technicians are male, outnumbering women in the field. Oregon State is part of a team working with the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on a long-term study.
The current time is 5:14. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Three blind mice, George, John, and Michael. See how they run. George W. tells us constantly that he's always on the alert to make America secure from foreign terrorists. But whoa! He then okays a $6.8 billion deal to let a government-owned company from the United Arab Emirates take over the operation of six major U.S. ports. Holy Osama, shrieked George's Republican allies. The UAE was a financial and operational base for the 9/11 crash bombers. Our ports are terribly vulnerable to terrorists as it is, but putting the UAE in charge is madness. But George bristled, saying he'll veto any congressional effort to stop it. Then came John, Treasury Secretary John Snow. Failure to complete this deal, he cried, would, quote, tell the world that investments in the United States from certain parts of the world aren't welcome. That sends a terrible message. No, it doesn't, John. It sends an honest and strong homeland security message. Next, Michael came running out to embrace the deal. Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security Czar. His sole job is to defend America, but suddenly he went all wobbly on us. We have to balance the paramount urgency of security against the fact that we still want to have a robust global trading system, he proclaimed. Aha! While the Bushites like to talk tough and fly the flag of national security, their foremost loyalty is to the flag of global corporate power. It's received little coverage, but the UAE now ranks behind only Saudi Arabia and Israel as corporate America's top trading partner in the Middle East. Also, for 2 years, the Bushites have quietly been negotiating a corporate-backed free trade deal with this oil monarchy. They don't want anything to squirrel these corporate ties, even if it requires giving the emirs control of 6 of our ports. This is Jim Hightower saying, for Bush and Company, money even trumps national security. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News following our new local newscast. At 5:55, hear Independent Native News. Then at 6, hear Labor Radio. Bill Zimmerman's guests are Barbara Dudley and Dan Cantor, discussing fusion voting and the new Working Families Party in Oregon. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Barry. Tonight's weather, showers with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Corvallis will have rain showers with a low of 37. And Hood River can expect rain with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow, showers likely with highs around 50 degrees. Corvallis will have rain showers with a high of 52, and Hood River can also expect rain showers in a high of 52 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The advisory council that influences how California's ocean salmon fisheries are managed is scheduled to meet in Seattle this week. Foremost on their agenda is how to reverse the declining king salmon population in the Klamath River. The California Report's Sarah Varney has more.
The Pacific Fishery Management Council is expected to recommend a series of options. Those could include limiting the area where salmon fishing can occur along the Northern California coast, shortening the sport and commercial seasons, or implementing an outright fishing ban. Dan Bacher is managing editor of Fish Sniffer magazine. He says nothing the council is considering will address the root cause of the declining salmon population.
This is like when somebody has cancer, giving them a Band-Aid for a cut on their finger. You know, I think what this really indicates is that the federal and state governments need to focus their management on fixing the habitat.
The decline of salmon in the Klamath is due in part, say biologists, to water temperatures. Scientists say so much water is diverted for farming or blocked by dams that the shallow river warms, killing the fish, and allows parasites to flourish. 4 years ago, warm river water killed hundreds of thousands of mature and juvenile salmon. Federal regulators are expected to rule later this spring on the upcoming salmon season. For the California Report, I'm Sarah Varney.
Members of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission are considering killing sea lions to save salmon on the Columbia River. Faced with a low-run forecast for spring Chinook salmon on the Columbia and without the prospect of as many as 100 California sea lions feasting on them around the fish ladders at Bonneville Dam, Commissioner Dan Edge proposed the move. Section 120 of the federal 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act allows states to apply to kill seals and sea lions when they threaten salmon, steelhead, and trout that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. However, the act doesn't make killing sea lions easy. The last time it was invoked, back in the 1980s, state officials in Washington fought legal challenges for 5 years. The officials wanted to get permission to kill 4 California sea lions that were wiping out a federally listed run of winter-run steelhead that migrate through the locks from Puget Sound into Lake Washington. Even then, the sea lions were not killed. Rather, they were eventually given to a marine amusement park. The opinions of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KABU.
The cost of a trip to the pharmacy in Oregon is rising for some people. Those who have a lot of expensive medications can find themselves in the Medicare prescription drug donut hole. KABU's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Some Oregonians are beginning to fall through the donut hole in their prescription drug coverage plan. When Congress passed the new Medicare prescription drug coverage, it created a hole to limit federal costs. So when an individual's prescription drug costs reach about $2,000, they have to pay for all of the next $2,800 before their coverage picks up again. Barry Donenfeld with Northwest Senior and Disabled Services says it's a rude awakening for some.
This is something that the average consumer probably isn't even remotely aware of. It hasn't been publicized very well. The average consumer probably thinks I'm going to pay a premium and some kind of copay and everything else is covered, just like regular insurance.
Donenfeld said this is an economic blow for people on fixed incomes.
This $2,800 that they're going to have to come up with in cash to keep their medications going could be a significant hit on their budgets.
The Oregon Department of Human Services says they're already hearing from people who've reached that level since the plan went into effect in January. Some experts say there are other ways to limit Medicare spending without coverage gaps, including allowing the federal government to negotiate for lower drug prices. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KABU News.
The Columbia newspaper reports that the U.S. Army expects to transfer ownership of Camp Bonneville to Clark County this spring. The facility is described as a munition-studded former military training site, 5 miles east of the Vancouver city limits. The transfer has been repeatedly delayed, partly because of an unknown amount of unexploded howitzer shells and other munitions littering the 3,800-acre site, which was used for training between 1909 and 1995. County officials say a 4 to 5 year cleanup plan, costing the federal government about $25 million, can eventually make the expanse safe as a public park. However, ongoing revelations of ordnance and chemical contamination, even after 11 years, has prompted opponents to say the government is acting hastily. Ammunition stored or used at Camp Bonneville included artillery, mortars, landmines, practice grenades, and small arms munitions.
Researchers say weight may be a factor in how effectively birth control pills work. One of the only studies in the nation to evaluate ovulation and weight is being conducted at Oregon Health and Science University. Experts say oral contraceptives do not come in differing strengths according to a patient's weight, such as other medications. Several recent studies have suggested a higher rate of birth control failure in heavy women. A new study, however, will track weight and effectiveness more closely. Participants will be given breast and pelvic exams, a pap smear, a urine pregnancy test, and a blood test to check for ovulation. The study will last about 12 weeks.
And now an update on eco-activist Rod Coronado. Arizona Indy Media received the following information via email at about 2 p.m. today. Coronado appeared before Judge Jeffrey Miller in San Diego this morning. Judge Miller set another hearing on the federal motion to detain him for March 23rd and then released him. On Friday, Tucson federal magistrate Charles Pyle released Rod on bail in Arizona, but Coronado had to report to San Diego federal court on Monday. This appearance was for a hearing regarding a motion entered last week by prosecutors for a stay of his release. It's assumed that Coronado is now on his way back to Tucson.
And that does it for the first half of the KABU Evening News for Monday, March 6, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kabu.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kabu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer is Martha Odom. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Carlos Chavez, Isaac Kaplan-Wolner, and Kirk Vanderveer. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Noah Eaton. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News following our newscast, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m., Abe and Joe host Talk Radio. They'll discuss nuclear proliferation, abortion, and when the levee breaks. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Marianne Barasadiak, speaks with Cheryl Strayed, an award-winning Portland writer whose first novel, Torch, is about love, loss, and redemption in a working-class family. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Kimberla Lawson-Roby, author of seven novels, including the latest, Changing Faces. At 10, Perfa Gurung interviews filmmaker Mark Manning about his documentary Caught in the Crossfire, the untold story of Fallujah. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts an interview with members of Oregon Children's Theater's production of The Giver. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 6, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Pentagon releases the names of hundreds of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay who have yet to know the accusations against them. And FSRN speaks with Afghani Member of Parliament Malalai Joya about the warlords still ruling the country.
Because I'm young, till I have energy, I will try to serve my people. And in another hand, I try to expose the enemies of Afghanistan.
All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Today, the Army Corps of Engineers resumed demolition of 120 severely damaged homes in New Orleans, the vast majority in the city's Lower Ninth Ward. Christian Roseland has more.
A small bulldozer tore apart a structure sitting in the middle of Winthrop Street in the city's Lower Ninth Ward today, the first of the homes scheduled for demolition this week. The crew was accompanied by cadaver-sniffing dogs, as remains continue to be found in the area. John Fogarty of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
What we're looking at now is starting to move into some areas north of Claiborne where structures have floated into the right-of-way. We need to get those cleared so that that continuing effort of restoring those utilities, those water lines, those utility lines for either gas, power, we need to get those structures out the way so those utility companies can come in there and restore those.
The Lower Ninth Ward still does not have potable water and few homes have electric service. The City of New Orleans says that it has mailed out demolition notices to the last known addresses of homeowners. Michelle Shin of the aid organization Common Ground, which opposed the bulldozing in December, said her organization has not been in contact with any residents who were to receive said notification. The City of New Orleans has not said when it will resume demolition of the other 1,800 homes that it plans to remove. For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
The South Central farmers at the nation's largest urban garden are facing eviction tomorrow at midnight by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. KPFK's Kelly Barnes reports.
Last night, a community strategy meeting was followed by a candlelight vigil to help keep the farm in the hands of the 350 low-income families that work the 14 acres. Despite the fact the farmers have raised $9 million to buy the garden, developer Ralph Horowitz is demanding $16.35 million, even though he paid just over $5 million to buy it back from the city in 2003. Farmers say that sale was a backroom deal, and they're not willing to consider a compromise offered by the mayor's office of accepting 4 or 5 acres at the current location and a few smaller plots throughout the city. So far, the mayor has not responded to farmers' demands of a citywide town hall meeting on the issue, in particular on the legality of the transfer of land back to Horowitz after the city took it under eminent domain. Tonight, the community is expected to turn out in force in support of the farmers, a continuation of the 24-hour presence at the farm for the last several months. In L.A. for FSRN, I'm Kelly Barnes for People Without Borders.
In a unanimous decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that military recruiters must be allowed onto the campuses of any college or university that receives federal funding.
This knocks down a legal challenge raised by some law schools that question the nature of the don't ask, don't tell policy that recruiters practice. Universities receive some $35 billion a year in federal funding. The Hamas-dominated Palestinian parliament's first legislative session ended today with the walkout of Fatah party legislators. They were opposing a move to challenge powers that were granted to President Abbas in the final days of the previous parliament. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has announced plans to evacuate additional West Bank settlements and defend Israel's permanent borders if the Kadima party of the acting prime minister wins national elections later this month. Manar Jabrin has the story.
Acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced yesterday that 17 settlement outposts would be cleared in the first stage of a four-year withdrawal plan. The evacuated settlers of these outposts will be relocated to major settlement blocks. Unlike last year's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, Israel is not planning a military disengagement from the evacuated West Bank land. Mr. Olmert has indicated that Israel will hold on to the Jordan Valley as well as East Jerusalem and the major settlement blocks of Ma'ali Adumim, Ariel, and Gosh Atzion as part of a final settlement. The move would cement Israeli control over the most heavily populated settlements in the West Bank, where Israel is building a controversial separation wall. All settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are illegal under international law. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jabrin.
Over 500 migrant workers took to the streets of Hong Kong yesterday to call on the government to increase the minimum wage that was lowered in 2003. Dante Tosa has more.
Hundreds of migrant workers held signs saying, "Stop modern slavery, wage increase now." These domestic workers are employed in private homes throughout Hong Kong. In 2003, the minimum wage was lowered from $470 to $428 U.S. dollars a month. With the government announcement in the new year that Hong Kong is no longer in a financial crisis, the workers are demanding that the elimination of a $50 tax levied against migrant domestic workers and a return to the pre-2003 minimum wage of $470. There are over 200,000 migrant workers in Hong Kong, many of them from the Philippines, Indonesia, and Thailand. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dante Toza reporting from Hong Kong.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
NATO has once again signaled that it will be the dominating force in Afghanistan before the end of the year. The United States has remained in the background, though, saying their troop levels will decrease by less than 20%. As Leanne Caldwell reports from D.C., some policy experts say the move will relieve some troop strain for other U.S.-led missions.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization will increase troop levels from 9,000 to 21,000 troops before the end of the year, and they will also expand to all parts of Afghanistan, even those in which the fighting tends to be most common.
Which means that by the end of the year, that Afghanistan could be a NATO mission. As a matter of fact, I think Afghanistan will be a NATO mission.
General James L. Jones is head of European NATO Command. The general says the toughest challenge NATO will have is gaining control of the narcotics production in that country. He also said that warlords have a stake in every aspect of life there. NATO will attempt peacekeeping and nation-building efforts.
And I'm particularly pleased by the will that nations have shown to do more in Afghanistan in particular, because that's a challenging mission.
A transfer of NATO precludes the idea that the United States will reduce their troop levels, but the U.S. has been vague. They announced in December they will reduce their troop levels by 3,000 ahead of the NATO transfer, but have given few details. They have declined to say how many troops will be under NATO head and which will continue what they call the offensive, the fighting of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in that country. General Jones revealed a bit more detail on the U.S.'s role.
The U.S.-led coalition that wants to continue the counter-terrorist mission, that is the offensive, military mission, will do so, continue to do so under a special arrangement under the U.S. Central Command, while the rest of the nations of ISAF will continue to do their, for all intents and purposes, it'll be one headquarters. It will have a unity of effort, and we'll just have that slight little difference about the military forces and how they're used.
James Dobbins, Director of International Security and Defense Policy at the conservative Rand Corporation, he says the complete transfer to NATO is long overdue.
it's been discussed at NATO headquarters for more than a year. It has been planned and agreed at least for the last several months. So it is going forward along a pretty much pre-agreed schedule.
26 NATO countries will have troops in Afghanistan, and 10 non-NATO countries will also provide assistance. John Pike with GlobalSecurity.org, a group of security experts that hope to reduce war, said this decision for NATO to move into the dangerous southeastern Afghanistan is because of heavy persuasion from the United States.
The European attitude towards Afghanistan operations is basically much more positive than it is towards the Iraqi adventure. And I think that the U.S. government has been of the view that if Europe supports the pacification of Afghanistan, they should do so with troops and free up American troops to go over to Iraq and other trouble spots.
NATO will not only expand in Afghanistan, it will expand its missions in northern Africa and along the West African coast. General Jones said NATO will take a more proactive stance to global security. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf is accusing Afghanistan's defense ministry and intelligence of conspiring against his country. His comments come in response to Afghanistan's recent accusation that Pakistan isn't doing enough to stop Taliban and Al-Qaeda operatives from crossing the border and taking refuge in Pakistan. Both countries are considered allies in the U.S. war on terror, but as they publicly trade accusations, it's rarely mentioned that former Taliban and other warlords are serving in Afghanistan's parliament. We're joined in studio by Afghan Member of Parliament Malalai Joya. History was made just a few months ago when Afghanistan held its first session of parliament in 30 years, and I imagine that when the people's history is written, your name will appear on those pages. You took a stand and began to denounce the presence of warlords serving in the parliament. Can you talk about who these people are serving in the Afghan parliament?
We have different kind of warlords in our country, especially in the parliaments, and they are those people that they did their test from 1992 till 1996 in our country. All of these criminals, they now they have unfortunately mask of democracy. Without asking them why they did lots of crimes, once again as the delegates they found way in the parliaments, and of course how they found way in the parliaments in this important place by using foreign supports, they had foreign supports, and by using lots of money, millions of dollars they received during the war under the name of innocent people, especially orphans and the widows and poor people in of Afghanistan, and also they have lots of gun, they have power, and they did lots of cheatings in during the election period.
Let's talk about those orphans and those widows. What type of war crimes are you referring to?
During the war period, of course, they killed lots of innocent people, especially Northern Alliance. Now, most of them, they are in power in the cabinet of Afghanistan, some of them, and some of them, they are in the parliament, and they killed lots of innocent people. For example, only in Kabul, they killed 65,000 people in Kabul, and they now our people telling them criminals, and they should go to the National International Justice Fest and teleport joy to our people that why they did these crimes.
You've had death threats made against you after speaking out. You've survived 4 assassination attempts. How has your life and your personal safety been affected since you've criticized the warlords?
Of course that every day I receive lots of threats to this. Even I had some interview here in U.S. Last day, yesterday, through phone during interview. But also I receive lots of support of my people, and it gives me more energy and more hopes. But on another hand, those people that they are threatening me to death, for example, even in Canada, they threat me to death. In Kabul, those enemies, especially that they are in power and parliament, they become aware that I had tripped and I exposed them. They said that warning me that when she returned, we will know what we will do with her and like this. Several times I said I will never afraid from these kind of threats and deaths that you are doing, because I believe in democracy, I believe to freedom and woman rights in my country, and I'm a freedom loving woman, and because I'm young, till I have energy, I will try to serve my people, and in another hand, I try to expose the enemies of Afghanistan, those people that they have mask of democracy, and they just want to be in power right now.
Malalai Joya is a member of the Afghan Parliament, currently in the U.S. on a speaking tour. Join us tomorrow for part two of this interview. According to Guantanamo Bay hearing transcripts released by the Pentagon late Friday, hundreds of detainees continue to wait in anguish without knowledge of why they're being held as prisoners and what future lies ahead after years of confinement. Yan Mei Shea has more from Washington, D.C.
Ahmed Abdul Azizi has been detained at Guantanamo Bay for more than 3 years. He said he has been interrogated 50 times without being charged with any crime. He fears freedom will never come and told his lawyer, "We are in a grave here." Many other cases documented in the transcripts echo the same frustration and despair. Roughly 500 prisoners are held as suspected terrorists at the U.S. naval base in eastern Cuba. Charges have been filed against only 10 of them. A Guantanamo Bay prison spokesman, Army Major Jeffrey Ware, says all the inmates have valid security or intelligence reasons to be there. But Abdur Sayyad Rahman certainly disagrees. He identified himself as a poor chicken farmer from Pakistan who was taken from home by police in 2001. It turned out during a hearing that he was wrongly arrested as a Taliban official who has a similar name. Rahman said he was told by an American that he'd be freed in a couple of days. But after waiting anxiously in vain, he bemoaned, "I never saw that American again, and I'm still here." The 5,000-page transcript of hearings were released after a successful Freedom of Information Act lawsuit by the Associated Press. Jamana Musa, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Domestic Human Rights and International Justice, says the release of the document is at least a step forward, breaking the seal of secrecy at the prison.
At the very least, it's an opportunity to get a glance into who's in Guantanamo, who these people are.
A Defense Department spokesman, Major Paul Svierskos, says, holding detainees in Guantanamo keeps enemy combatants from fighting against the U.S. and its allies. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
Although Ciudad Juarez has become infamous for the brutal murders of young women, the region isn't the only place in Mexico where crimes against women go routinely unpunished. According to official statistics from the Mexican federal government, Oaxaca has become a hotspot for gender-based violence. Vladimir Flores reports.
En el año pasado documentamos 33.
Human rights attorney Jessica Sanchez Maya is part of a women's organization that has been documenting crimes of violence against women in Oaxaca. She says that last year there were 33 documented cases of murdered women and girls. 3 months into 2006, there are already 10 cases. The attorney comments that the documentation process is complicated given that these crime figures are not public.
Unfortunately, the only way we as organizations have of following this is through newspaper reports. All of the data that we provide comes from what appears in the crime section of the newspaper.
Although Oaxacan Governor Ulises Ruiz signed an agreement last year with the federal government's special commission to investigate the murders of women, his administration does not keep separate homicide statistics for women. Local journalist Silvia Chabela Riva has been covering women's issues for years for the Noticias newspaper.
As a reporter, information has been very difficult to obtain because I say that all of the government offices are totally closed to these subjects.
The lack of documentation is only one aspect of the phenomenon of gender-based violence here. One recent case illustrates why women's groups are calling for reform to what they say are outdated and discriminatory laws. In 2004, Heriberto Vázquez was given a 2-year sentence after he confessed to beating his wife to death. Vázquez was able to avoid a regular homicide charge by saying that he killed his wife because she was adulterous. He was then charged with and convicted of an honor killing, which carries a much lighter sentence. Vázquez was later freed under a program to release indigenous prisoners awaiting trial or convicted of petty crimes. He now holds a position in his town's government. The state government has also been criticized for insensitivity towards women who report domestic abuse or other acts of aggression. Such is the case of this woman who went to the state to report domestic abuse by her ex-husband.
Where I went to file my complaint that this person was beating me and abusing me, they told me, "Miss, show me where he hit you. In order for us to see the domestic violence that you say is happening, you have to come with bruises or blood so that we can see." So one just leaves. I left upset because where's the support for women that they say they can give?
A team of representatives from civil organizations today presented a detailed report to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on the situation of violence against women in Oaxaca with the hope that the commission will make some binding recommendations that will force the state's authorities to take concrete steps to improve the current situation. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech, Radio News.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
Upcoming national elections in Italy next month are just too close to call, although Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's government might be enjoying its last 2 months of power. Berlusconi's administration is still pushing hard against environmental law and engineering constraints to build the longest bridge of its kind in the world connecting Sicily to the south of Italy. But opposition from both sides of the coastline is growing. From Sicily, Naomi Fowler reports.
Sicily and the south of Italy have always been isolated politically, economically, and historically from the wealthier north. The ferries that cross the Straits of Messina are old and slow, but Sicilians here today believe building a 3,360-meter-long bridge is not the best way forward.
The cost of the bridge is about 10 billion of euro, and 10 billion of euro is a lot of money. So this is a big cake to share. So there's a political will to do this. They don't care about the people. Berlusconi is the major businessman of Italy, so he has a lot of friends.
For an estimated 10% of the cost of building the bridge, many Sicilians prefer to modernize the ferry services. As it is, the crossing from Italy to Sicily only takes about 20 minutes. There are many other logistical problems too for the bridge. Environmental campaigner Anna Giordano.
This area, it has been identified as important bird area for the European community. And now, all the Strait of Messina, including the sea, is protected by the European law. And if I was not discovering this, we didn't know, because the regional government published the law without the map.
The Messina Straits is also in a seismic zone. The Italian government admits engineers have not yet come up with a structure that can withstand tremors and quakes. High winds also mean the bridge would be closed anyway for 3 months a year.
I think that before to offer something that is not necessary, you must give to the people what is necessary. To have the water in all the houses, to have a better highway that actually what we have not only in Calabria but also in Sicily is absolutely out of a normal civil country. This we need. To have really public transportation, to use the public service by train. It takes 8 hours to go for 330 kilometers.
A structure like a bridge is the upstint work that comes from elsewhere that is somehow thrown, and Sicilians and Calabrians should accept it, but is something
like coming from Mars.
And it's not the first time Sicilians have failed to benefit from investment from the north. Anti-bridge campaigner Santi Silito.
In Sicily there are many refineries in Gela, in Syracuse, in Milazzo, etc. And no money to Sicily, but lots of pollution. But Sicilians for a while believed that this was the industrial revolution that could benefit them, actually created only pollution. They need to have places where to wash the money, and the bridge would be the perfect chance for them, the perfect opportunity.
The 20,000 Sicilians demonstrating here today believe this project will benefit few at the cost of many. They say the money would be better spent addressing chronic underinvestment in their social services and infrastructure here. If Prodi and his left-wing party wins the Italian elections in April, the bridge project will be no more. This is Naomi Fowler in Messina for Free Speech Radio News.
South Dakota's Governor Mike Rounds has signed a bill to ban nearly all abortions in the state, directly challenging the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized the procedure in all states in 1973. Meanwhile, citizens in Mississippi have begun collecting signatures for a ballot initiative which, if approved, would also outlaw abortion in all cases unless the life of the mother or fetus was in danger. The group behind the proposal believes that if passed, it will be challenged in court, but is hopeful that with two new Supreme Court justices, a challenge to the law would fall in their favor, which could lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision which gave women the right to choose to terminate their pregnancy. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports from Jackson, Mississippi, home to the only abortion clinic still open in the entire state.
You know, most women come here and get their babies chilled at between 8 and 12 weeks, and they're told inside just to ease their conscience. It's not a baby. It's just a tissue, but it's already developing. It's fully developed at this stage.
Matthew is standing outside the gates of the Jackson Women's Health Organization on North State Street. He takes turns with other people handing out pamphlets with pictures of fetuses at various stages of development. Some of the brochures also allude to links between having an abortion and getting AIDS or breast cancer. Matthew's not yet involved with gathering some of the more than 107,000 signatures, which will be needed to get what's been titled the Human Life Amendment on the Mississippi ballot in November of 2007, but he's confident it will get the signatures and be passed by the voters.
We have a law on the books now that says that we can take the life of a human being because it's an inconvenience to us. It's wrong. And so any law that we can work to change, we want to do that.
Inside the clinic, half a dozen African-American women sit in the waiting room in silence, some with hoods pulled over their heads. This is the only clinic left in the state of Mississippi which performs abortions. Six others have been closed over the years in the face of death threats to doctors and constant protests. A staff member estimates that 65 women a week, some from neighboring states, come in for the legally required ultrasound, counseling on alternatives, and education on potential health risks, which must include a mention of breast cancer. After the state mandated 24-hour waiting period, 80 to 90% of the women go through with the procedure. The two visits to the clinic also provide opportunity for anti-abortion activists on the sidewalk outside to speak to women like Brittany, who came from 2 hours away with her cousin Jeremy, in an effort to make them reconsider.
But she's at work right now. I can call her. We can follow me over to her office and get a free ultrasound.
I was not even expecting this for anybody to be waiting for you to hand off a pamphlet to me. Man, I'm not going to do this easy. Hell no.
God is working in your heart right now because you are soft. Your heart, I mean, you may think you're hard.
According to the clinic's website, Mississippi has the highest teen birth rate in the country and one of the highest infant mortality rates. 60 to 70% of the women who visit the clinic are African American.
No, I'm going in to get the ultrasound and everything done. I'm paying $100 for all these. But I can keep my money in my pocket. You
keep
saying?
Your money to save up so you can get your own place. That's why when you do have your kid be able to say you got a home cause. Me, you know how I've been. I've been moving here since I was little. I ain't never had no place to really call home.
Only thing I'm worried about is my child coming out with some kind of physical problems because I've been smoking, I've been drinking, and now I got to deal with that. But that's my fault.
Yeah.
Because I knew.
The Ultimate Coalition for Unborn Children, the group leading the petition drive, believes that the ballot language, which would forbid taking the life of a person, and then defines person to include all stages of biological development from conception until natural death, would lay the groundwork for an overturn of Roe v. Wade. The campaign website features clips from the Supreme Court arguments in Roe v. Wade. All of the sound bites, like this exchange between Justice Potter Stewart and Sarah Weddington, the attorney for Roe, seek to illustrate that if the fetus is determined a person, abortion would then be unconstitutional.
If it were established that an unborn fetus is a person within the protection of the 14th Amendment, you would have almost an impossible case here,
would you? I would have a very difficult case.
Certainly would.
The Ultimate Coalition for Unborn Children did not respond to requests for an interview, but David Rogers, the group's leader, told the AP he believes the replacement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor with Samuel Alito improves the Human Life Amendment's chances of withstanding a Supreme Court challenge. For FSRN, reporting from Jackson, Mississippi, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 6th of March. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In a landmark moment, the first members of the Navajo Nation Board of Education were appointed by Navajo President Joe Shirley Jr. on Friday. Correspondent Eric Mack has more.
The board was created by a Navajo Nation law passed last summer that amended the nation's education code, or Title 10. The move will give the nation greater control over what is taught in Navajo schools, according to Shirley's spokesman, George Hardeen.
Now the Navajo people can determine for themselves what is important in the education of their children. And certainly that includes traditional academics, but it also includes Navajo language, history, culture.
Hardeen said the nation has been working towards this moment since the Treaty of 1868, when the federal government took over the education of Navajo children.
Since those times, tribal leaders have urged the people to get educated, to take the step of education. One leader named Manuelito said, "It's a ladder, and climb that ladder."
President Shirley appointed 6 members to the board last week. Their first task will be to select a superintendent of schools. The remaining 5 members to the 11-seat board will be elected next fall. For Independent Native News, I'm Eric Mack.
Congress has passed a bill which allows Alaska Native corporations to issue stock to shareholders' descendants. Legislation which changed the majority vote needed to authorize such a distribution passed the U.S. House last week. It's already passed the Senate, and as Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, all that's needed now is a signature from the president.
The Juneau-based Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation, Fairbanks-based Doyon, and some other Native corporations have been asking for years for a smaller majority vote requirement, and they got it through congressionally authorized changes to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The legislation passed by Congress removes the requirement that adding shareholders be approved by a majority of all possible voting shares. That's known as a supermajority. It replaces it with a simple majority of all ballots cast for a meeting. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and Representative Don Young authored identical measures to change the majority vote rules. Murkowski's bill made it through the Senate in December. It was presented on the House floor by Representative Rick Renzi of Arizona.
The bill eases certain restrictions placed on Native corporations that has made it practically impossible for many of them to issue new stock to young Alaskan Natives.
Murkowski, in an earlier interview, said adding shareholders is important to expand corporate involvement.
What we're trying to do is to allow for enrolling of future generations of stockholders into Alaska's Native corporation.
The federal law that created Alaska Native corporations made shareholders out of most tribal members born by December 18th of 1971. But in most cases, members born since then have only become shareholders through a gift or inheritance. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
A controversial casino proposed near the Illinois-Wisconsin border will be the subject of a meeting tonight in Zion, Illinois. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio has details.
Wisconsin's Menominee Tribe and some developers in Kenosha want to turn the Dairyland Dog Track into a casino and entertainment complex. Illinois State Representative Joanne Osmond represents the area near Zion and is holding tonight's meeting. She says the Menominee's goal of hiring 80% of the casino workers from southeastern Wisconsin does not make sense.
The citizens in my 61st district could definitely get to the casino for employment faster than they could come down from Milwaukee.
Osman says she also worries about people drinking alcohol at the casino and then driving through Zion and other border communities. But a spokesperson for the Menominee tribe says precautions would be taken to mitigate any traffic problems, and the aim to hire Wisconsin residents would not preclude people from Illinois from working at the gaming complex. Wisconsin's governor and the federal government still need to approve the casino plan. I'm Chuck Quernbach.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.
Independent Native News is a production of KUAC.